From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Yesterday on the program, business leaders made the case for bumping up funding for public schools and universities. Today, we continue the education theme with a conversation with William Cederberg. As Utah's commissioner for higher ed, Cederberg has been busy. He set an ambitious goal of getting college degrees and certificates into the hands of more Utahns. He's withstood an attack on tenure, and he's trimmed budgets to do more with less. Last week, he announced his retirement, and today on the program, he's joining us to tell us what more needs to be done for the state's 8 colleges and universities. Plus, a new charter school targets new immigrants and refugees. The Utah International School unveils its plans. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. When the economy's down, people go back to school, and here in Utah, college campuses have seen a 22% boom in student enrollments. Pair that with tight budgets, and you get a sense of the workload and the challenges facing my guests today on the program. We're talking about higher ed in Utah with Dr. William Cederberg. He is Utah's 7th Commissioner of Higher Education. He has a bachelor's degree in education and political science from, is it Mankato? I'll turn on your mic. Mankato State University in Minnesota, and a master's degree.
And Jennifer, you pronounced that correctly.
Okay,
a lot of people say Mankato or something, but it's Mankato.
Lovely. And a master's degree and doctorate, both in political science from Michigan State. He served in the Michigan State Senate for 12 years. He was president of Ferris State University in Big Rapids, Michigan for 9 before coming to Utah in 2003 to become president of Utah Valley State College, now Utah Valley University, and he's been commissioner of higher ed since 2007. He joins me now in studio, and good morning, Dr. Cederberg. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Jennifer. It's great to be here.
Later on in the program, we're talking about the world in a classroom, a conversation about a new charter school for refugees and for new immigrants. But first, higher ed, how can the state keep tuition affordable? What about those high college dropout rates that we're facing? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Before we get into some of the things on your to-do list, Dr. Cederberg, you spent many years pursuing your own education. You've been a university president twice. How is the college experience different today from the way it was when you were a student?
Makes me feel real young and vibrant here with that lead question at that. I'm going to go back to a comment my father once made to me. My father was a college administrator and faculty member, and he made a very interesting point when he retired and became involved in elder hostel programs. And he said when he was a student back in the 30s and 40s that there was a sense of sacrifice going to college and living in less than ideal circumstances and really scraping by and really making do and really kind of having a maximum effort and sacrifice to go to college. And then by the 1980s, and he was talking then, the world had shifted where we were looking more at the institutions of higher education to be cutting edge in their technology that they had and doing the most advanced work in computer science research and in providing the total experience for students with the best of residence hall experiences and stuff. And I think that trend that my father pointed out continues to this day, but in a more heightened and positive way, and that is that society today really looks to higher education institutions as the key to their state's and the nation's future. And we really have to protect and advance these institutions for society's purpose. So maybe this sounds a little bit like a political statement, but I do think that what used to be kind of a nice thing for a society to have and has shifted to a must for a state or a society, and that it is absolutely essential that we do it right.
Because of this experience that you've had, both as an administrator, a professor, now commissioner of higher education, you understand what makes a vibrant campus community and the campus experience for both professors and students. What do you see as the most challenging issue facing Utah campuses today?
Well, you've kind of intertwined two variables within that question. First, on the dynamic of a campus, clearly the campus at its heart is the dynamic between faculty members and students. There is something really transformative that happens in the college years and on a college campus that is a little bit magical, if you will. There's just that personal development side where people are different after going through the college experience than they were coming into it. And it's a combination of the interaction with faculty and the interaction with their peers as they mature and develop. So that dynamic is really critical. And we're blessed in Utah of having a very solid group of faculty that are really committed to students and institutions and staff that are committed to students. So on one sense, your question, the dynamic is very important. The other aspect as to what's changed in Utah and what's the highest priority in Utah, really the growth in Utah, population is just, we're going to double in size, the number of young people in the schools, just to keep up, just to hold our place in where we are, it's going to take a massive effort on the part of the state. And then if we're going to leapfrog other states in our economic growth and our ability to respond to the economic challenges, we're going to have a really Herculean effort to respond to that those aspirations.
Can you be specific? What kind of growth are we looking at?
Well, if you take a look in Utah, we expect the population to double over the next 25 years or so. And in higher education, we're going to have to add about 76,000 more students into our higher education institutions in order to achieve our goal of having two-thirds of the public with some form of post-secondary credential. With population growth and with the increased demand to get a better educated population, we're going to have to increase by our institutions by about 40% over the next 10 years. So we've got a challenge just to grow the enterprise, if you will, based upon the population growth as well as the increased demands of the 66%.
So in a very practical sense, more classrooms, more professors, more money.
Right, and that's part of our planning efforts are to figure out how to do this. On one hand, it would be easy to say, well, we can figure out how many square feet per student and what we need, and we have those calculations. But there's also an element that we know that technology is changing the world, and we need to figure out how many students can do things online, how can we incorporate the use of technology to reduce the demands on physical space and move it more into virtual space in the classroom. So for the first time, the audience may or may not be interested in this, but for the first time, we're really challenging the institutions to come up with technology master plans tied to the educational outcomes and hopefully achieve some efficiencies in space utilization by doing that.
I wanted you to reach back to your experience at Utah Valley University. It saw tremendous growth
and it continues to,
especially during your tenure. You saw the transition from a college to a university. I guess I'm curious about how long state institutions can have an open enrollment policy, which means anybody who applies, anybody who wants to take a class can.
Okay. Well, I think if you look at, if you were to come back in Utah, and Jennifer, you're younger than I am, so you'll be able to do this, come back in 30, 40 years and look at the state of Utah, and I think you're going to find at some point the state will have to develop additional community colleges that we currently don't have. Right now we ask Utah Valley and Weber State and Dixie to be community colleges as well as four-year institutions. I think you're going to see the growth of community colleges. I think you're going to see at some point, and I don't know when this happens and I don't know how it happens, but at some point the state public is going to say, let's fund those community colleges with a small property tax or maybe an additional sales tax or some way to finance education locally for so that education is not too expensive for students. So what we're going to have to do is to grow community colleges, and then we're going to have to really grow our four-year regional institutions and connect them very closely to the economic base and hopefully provide some financial capability for them to really be innovators within their regions.
Speaking with William Cederberg, he is Utah's 7th Commissioner of Higher Education, and we're talking about the state of higher ed here in the state. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Dr. Cederberg, so much of the higher ed discussion is dominated by money. On both ends, financing,
or lack of it,
paying for
right.
it, and for both students and for the public at large. Governor Herber unveiled his nearly $13 billion budget yesterday. How does higher ed make out?
Well, we did quite fine. I think the governor has prioritized education broadly for one of his top priorities. We were a little bit surprised with some of the recommendations, but very supportive of others. The governor's recognizing some growth, and for the first time in recent years, financing some of the growth in our enrollment. He's also supportive of a plan that we have to finance the outcomes of education and shift not just to from enrollment, but the shift to the number of degrees that are granted and specific performance indicators that we've identified. And that's really, I think, going to be the big thing in Utah over the coming years, will be to move from simply headcount on enrollment to performance and degrees generated. So the governor's budget recognized that for the first time. In addition to that, the governor built into the budget some specific things for the governor's Educational Excellence Commission. We're particularly interested in an initiative that he's supportive on technology-intensive courses. These will be hybrid concurrent enrollment classes offered jointly by the college and the high school, offered in the high school with the state-of-the-art technology, with open access material so that we don't get away from the textbooks. And the goal is to have at least 30 of these classes available so that the enterprising student can finish their general education requirement while they're in high school. That can save a whole years of college and expenses for students. We will be setting state standards on those 30 credit hours, and we'll be doing evaluation of the students according to those state standards. And so we're taking away, I don't know if you follow Clayton Christensen's writing on disruptive innovations, but one of his disruptive innovations is kind of separating the control of the content, which is now held by a faculty member, and saying the content is somewhat different. The role of the faculty member will be more of a mentor and a guide and an assistant and an evaluator, and the content will be provided by our state resources. And so the governor is very supportive of that, and there's money in the budget to really move towards having at least 30 credits provided in concurrent enrollment in kind of the state-of-the-art delivery system. So that's a big step forward.
Hmm. You say that the governor wants to fund growth. That has not been the case over the last few years. I think that Utah has had one of the lower spending per student. I think it's $5,200 per full-time student. That's 27% less than the national average. So in many ways, Utah's colleges and universities have had to do what public schools have had to do, right, doing a lot more with less money.
We do all these statistics and compare ourselves with different states. We are somewhere either the most efficient or the third most efficient state in the United States in the dollars spent per degree generated. And we think we've been able to do that while sustaining the quality of our graduates from our institution. So we're very proud of that efficiency. Now, I got to add, with the legislature coming to session, we'd like to be less efficient and get a little bit more money, because we really are reaching the point that we're starting to turn students away. We saw that at Salt Lake Community College. We saw it at Dixie State College and at Utah Valley University. That we estimate probably right around 3,000 students that wanted to go to class were turned down in their ability to attend school because of the lack of funds to hire adjunct faculty and people to cover these courses. And so the budget really, we're very efficient. We're proud of that efficiency. But if we're going to respond to this growth in our population and the demands, we hope that the legislature will respond and provide some funding to do that.
We're speaking with Dr. William Cederberg. He is the commissioner of higher education here in the state of Utah. And we're talking about higher education. Is college affordable for you? Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255 or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Today on the program, college. Are you paying tuition? What do you think would improve the college experience at Utah's 8 campuses? And would you be willing to pay a little bit more in taxes to provide higher education for more people? Our guest this hour, Utah Commissioner of Higher Education, William Cederberg. And if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. A topic of discussion in the higher ed community lately has been the high number of students who start college and then, for whatever reason, drop out. What are some of the issues surrounding the high dropout rate?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right, Jennifer. The high dropout rate is really kind of a national disgrace in some respects. In Utah, we have about 24% of the population that has some college but not a degree. And in fact, we have 8% of the population within Utah that has at least 7 semesters of education but have not bothered to finish their degree for whatever reason. And so as we look at the goal of 66%, this is kind of low-hanging fruit, how to get people back into the classroom. But I think specifically we need to do a better job of keeping students on track and moving ahead. And we're part of a national organization called Complete College America that has kind of a detailed platform of how to do this. Parts of their platform are to fund completions as opposed to enrollments. And that would be a sea change in the way colleges think about recruiting students and getting them in the classroom. Another part of their platform is really fascinating to me is structure, is to say we give too many students too many options out there. So if you go up to the University of Utah, you might pick up their catalog and you'll have thousands of courses. And given the low number of counselors and advisors that we have, a student is kind of left adrift. And so this Complete College America is saying, no, we really ought to be more prescriptive and say these are the courses you're going to take. For example, math is a huge problem in Utah. And too many of our students don't take math their first year of college. They're afraid of it, so they postpone it. They just dally around and don't get around to taking math until 3 or 4 years later. And then if they don't do well in math, they might drop out. When I was at UVU, I had a meeting with 4 ladies that were all middle-aged or slightly older than middle-aged. And all of them had dropped out of college, and all of them said they dropped out for fear of taking a math class. And so we can structure it, get math done in high school or the first year of college. We can do a lot of good things. We can do a lot of good things online advising and using technology to do a better job of tracking students and reminding them how to do things. We can do a better job with our policies, for example. This is one of my little pet issues, and that is, very few college courses require attendance, and yet we know for freshman classes, if you're not there in class, your chances of passing aren't as great as if you're there. And if we just require attendance for math classes as freshmen, we can improve the retention rate significantly. So there's a lot of strategies that are being suggested. We're in the midst of trying to implement a lot of those, and we're really starting to measure more aggressively students' retention. Now, it's a huge issue in Utah because of Mormon missions that kids go on, but we try and take that into account and track students through the process. But it is a significant challenge for all of us.
And a large slice of the Utah student population that doesn't complete is women.
It's women. That's one of the big surprises of the last couple of years, and as we've done the analysis, is that we have a huge problem. We're 50th among 50 states in the number of women that complete their college education.
What's going on?
Well, the governor created a task force on that and get right at that. And we really think that it's kind of a social phenomenon, if you will, the young marriages, and then with the rising price of tuition, I think a lot of young ladies are going into the workforce and dropping out of college to put their husband through, and then they might have kids right away and make it a lot harder to come back. And so I think there's a social thing going on in Utah that's a challenge. So we've gotten the church involved. We've gotten former Governor Eileen Walker involved. We've gotten a lot of leaders to try and get the message out to young ladies in Utah. Yes, you can be married. Yes, you can have kids, certainly, but complete your degree. Because we know the divorce rate is about at the national average here in Utah. We have one of the highest percentage of women in the workforce of any state. And so this kind of 1950s image of the couple with a woman staying at home with three happy little kids just doesn't apply anymore. And we have to break out of that and help young ladies be committed to completing their degrees.
We're speaking with Dr. William Cederberg, Commissioner of Higher Education. Another contributing factor, though, and I've experienced this as an adjunct professor at the U, a lot of my students are not ready. I mean, they have writing deficiencies. I've heard other professors say they don't have the minimum, and so they have to take remedial classes. And I think it's probably quite discouraging for those students to be in that position where they've enrolled in college and these classes are too hard.
There really is a significant issue in Utah about college readiness. And we're working closely with the State Board of Education and with the school districts, but there's so much more that can be done. And we're guilty in higher education, in my opinion, of sending the wrong message to the high school population. I know when I was at President at Utah Valley, we were an open door, open admission school. Anybody could come and enroll. We were encouraging students to take concurrent enrollment classes while they were in high school and didn't have any standards for enrolling in those concurrent enrollment classes. We never looked at transcripts when they enrolled in school. We never asked them to supply their high school transcripts. We gave away all our scholarships at the end of the junior year of high school. The high school graduation requirements were fairly minimal. And what it all led up to is that you could take the senior year off, essentially, unless you were really motivated and had strong parental support to move ahead. And so we've been working with the State Board of Education with the Common Core standards to raise the standards, trying to set some admission policies at UVU and elsewhere to get the word out there, take high school seriously, do a good job in high school before you matriculate into the college program. And we need to do report cards back to the school districts as to how their students are doing. We need to not let students move on when they're not able to do the writing and reading. And we've been kind of guilty of that as well. And State Auditor Carter kind of criticized the U for some of that. So anyway, there's a lot of work to be done. But Jennifer, back in the 80s, I did a survey of faculty back in Michigan. And 85% of the faculty in Michigan were just dismayed at the readiness statement of the students going into college back in the 80s. And in doing that survey, I went back and looked at surveys in the 50s and 60s, and the faculty there were always similarly dismayed at the lack of readiness on the part of the students. So you just may be a regular faculty member.
Maybe
you know
so.
That maybe somebody sent you the wrong students for the class.
Well, you know, back in my day, I had to walk barefoot through.
There you go. Way back then.
It's not just a struggle to keep students in the classroom and completing degrees, but there has been recent discussion about tenure. In the last legislative session, there was a bill to end tenure. It died in committee, but I think it was a wake-up call for folks in higher ed that they need to pay attention to this issue. The Board of Regents, of course, has given some attention, but where do things stand now? And I guess, do you understand the frustration with the tenure system as it stands?
Well, the answer to that is I hope so. I think I do. I was president of a school in Michigan, and we had a tenure system that had no post-tenure review. So once you got tenure, you were kind of exempt from any kind of evaluation. And I was president during a week-long faculty strike, and a good share of that strike was over requiring some form of post-tenure review with strong standards. And so I've lived that. I've lost some hair over that strike and the issues related to it. But we did have a very small number, but a number of faculty that had just kind of went out to lunch and were protected by tenure. That is not the case in Utah. And I think that there's a misconception of that. In Utah, we've strengthened our policies at the state level that each school will have a strong post-tenure review evaluation process, and basic incompetence in the classroom is just cause for removing that faculty member. So, Jennifer, you're teaching and you have tenure, and you just, like one of my faculty members back there, hadn't updated his pharmacy class notes for 30 years. He was still teaching pharmacy as he had taught 30 years previously.
Snoozer.
And you think about the dean, and I finally decided that faculty member was doing more harm than good. And so we assigned him to a class like 10 o'clock at night on Friday night and didn't enroll classes. Well, we took a strike and fixed that. But in Utah, we can and we're requiring the campuses to do post-tenure review, evaluation process, and if you just have basic incompetence in the classroom, you can take action. What tenure does protect and is absolutely critical in Utah is the ability to speak out, the ability to not be intimidated by the political process, the ability to conduct research that might be controversial in the public's eye, to teach things that might be a little unsettling to certain people. We have to protect that basic faculty right to do that. And so we're very much opposed to efforts to do away with tenure, because there is an element, and my friends in the legislature might not admit to it, but there is an element that some in the political process in the legislature like to throw their weight around from time to time, and sometimes there are controversies on college campuses. When I first got to Utah, we faced Michael Moore showing up, and in fact, you might get a charge out of this thing. I actually have a movie credit because a young student made a movie on the Michael Moore issue and played in theaters around the country, and my little bit of role got a credit for being in here. So I think we have to protect tenure. There's no doubt about that. But tenure is not a lifetime job guarantee. Everybody should be evaluated, and if they're incompetent, moved along.
But the discussion of tenure and even bringing up this thorny issue, coupled with some of the financial constraints that universities have been under, I mean, they haven't been able to lavish and recruit the best and the brightest. And I think at the end of the day, a university is judged on the quality of its instructors, mm-hmm. its teachers. So have you seen any evidence that these discussions about tenure, that the money issues, are keeping people from coming to the University of Utah, to Utah Valley University, other state institutions?
Well, I think that if the legislation had passed, banning tenure definitely would have been a negative result. I haven't seen any negative result because of the conversation about it, because it's going on in other states as well. I think there is, if there's one disappointment I have in the governor's budget that came out yesterday, was that we've been after additional money for the presidents to really reward their outstanding stars and to keep their top talent on the campus under merit pay. And that was not included in the governor's budget. We'll be pushing that with the legislature, is that we really, if there's a threat to the talent base within higher education, it's because of the lack of our salaries and stuff keeping up with the national levels. And we really need to be able to keep the best and the brightest within Utah and continue the progress we've made over the last few years with USTAR and some of the other initiatives.
We're speaking with Dr. William Cederberg, Utah Commissioner of Higher Education. I'm flipping through a report that you brought with you, Higher Ed Utah 2020. It's sort of your master plan, I imagine.
It is for a masterpiece.
A masterpiece.
That's what we like to think of it.
The action plan for improving access to universities, keeping university students strong and vibrant places. Many of the goals, though, do seem to be tied to jobs. And I guess I'm wondering, is it all about economics? I mean, is that the role that a college education plays now? I'm thinking back to a recent legislative debate where the humanities and the arts took a bit of a battering. With the so-called degree to nowhere. So in your mind, in the broadest sense, what is the place of the university? What role does higher education really play in our lives? Is it just a pathway to a job?
You've set me up. Thank you. I think you know the answer to that question. When a good senator raised the issue of degrees to nowhere, and I have one of those, a political science degree.
And, I have two.
Oh, you have two degrees to nowhere. Well, there you go. So you're twice nowhere. So that's good. Clearly, there's all sorts of different thoughts that crosses one's mind. Just a few of the things under consideration in my mind, and hopefully your audience is thinking about this thing. At one level, we really need to get away from talking about the workforce and talk about a talent force. And if you think about talent, then it's a little bit broader definition, but what the economy really needs are not workers that will line up in a row and march into the factory and produce 50 widgets and do it efficiently and all that. We really need the economy needs talent, and it needs the creative people that can produce video. It needs writers. It needs radio personalities. It needs talent. And if Utah is to prosper, we really have to maximize the human talent that's available for an ever-changing economic workplace. So one is concept is to shift from the workforce mindset to a talent force conversation. Another challenge that we have is to move from kind of the free market system so that right now if I want to be a political science major, I can be a political science major, and our number one degree in around America is psychology degrees, and my son has a psychology degree, and I got into these big debates. Why do you want that? It's a degree to nowhere. I sounded just like good senator on that thing. But I love it. You know, it's just what I want to do. So you have this free market issue, and there's some misalignment with what's needed over here and the talent needs within the state. Interestingly, that we really need to do a better job of educating the individuals as far as the opportunities. So we're looking at career pathways. We have UtahFutures.org, which is an online system for helping students know about the careers that are out there and opportunities and that are potential within the state. So we need to educate the individual market with the broader market needs, and that can kind of align these two particular markets. So that's a second concept. And the third concept is, and I think at the heart of your suggestion, is that we really think about what is going to be the characteristic of Utah or the characteristics of Utah that people want to move here, they want to live here, raise their family, and what kind of society do we want to create? We really need to have broadly educated people that are critical thinkers, that are writers, that are readers, that enjoy an intellectual conversation, might even listen to public radio and be engaged in some of this conversation. We need supporters of the arts. I always chuckle with, what do we advertise about an area, you know, as far as why would you move to Salt Lake City and et cetera. And oftentimes it's the arts and kind of the quality of life. And so quality of family life. We did a survey done here of 1,200 citizens here in the state of Utah, and we asked what the primary value of a higher education was. I expected it to be economics. It came back to be the highest quality is being a good parent and being helpful in raising your kids. So it's a long answer to your question, but we really have an opportunity, I think, to shape the quality of our community. And I like to say that the only strategy for doing that in a positive way, the absolutely only strategy a state has is through the doors of the higher education institutions. I mean, you just think, okay, what's your alternative plan for Utah? And you say, well, maybe we ought to mine more oil or mine more coal or whatever. But that'll produce maybe 3,000 jobs. What we really have to do is to create a vibrant, dynamic, innovative, entrepreneurial community with talent that can combine talent and grow companies. And That's right through the doors of the higher education system. And we literally have no choice, but no alternative strategy but that. And so many, many other countries are doing that far ahead of the United States. And in Utah, I'm not popular when I say this, but the data is very clear that Utah is falling behind the nation and other states, and falling far behind other countries in our commitment to education, our commitment to higher education institutions, in the value of education. Our young people have fewer degrees than old people here within the state. We're just headed in the wrong direction. And if Utah is going to be the kind of state that people want to live in, we really need to change that.
Hmm. You've set out quite an ambitious...
That's what I'm paid to say, by the way.
Well, you've got your points down and an ambitious plan, the Higher Ed Utah 2020 report. Many goals still yet to be completed, and yet last week you announced you're retiring. Yeah. Why are you leaving?
Well, you know, you can only have so much fun in a state, and then the joy just overtakes you. That's what I jokingly say. I'm just at that age where it's exciting to have a new adventure, and my wife and I decided it was time to look at some other options and to do some different things. And so I hope to continue to be engaged in higher ed in Utah, and that's yet to be kind of determined what that engagement would be. So I just have lots of options out there. And, you know, you're much too young to think about this, but there comes a time where you kind of have the ability to just kind of go and do what you want to do and pick and choose. And so I'm at that stage. And so it just seemed like a good time to do that.
I'm not as young as you think, but thanks for the compliment.
Dr.
Williams.
Radio, you know, it's I don't know, the audience knows that Jennifer is, what, 25 or something like that. So it's great. So.
You're my new best friend. Dr. William Cederberg, Utah's Commissioner of Higher Education. Thanks very much for your time today.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry we didn't get a lot of phone calls in. I was telling Jennifer earlier that I did this program once, and they mentioned that Joe the Plumber was coming on right after me, and the phone lines just went crazy. And that's not the political Joe the Plumber. That was just the regular Joe.
We'll have a plumber on next segment.
There you go.
Dr. Cederberg, thanks so much. Up next, we're going to be talking, shifting gears, still on the education topic, talking about refugees and new immigrants who will get their own charter school. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. Over the past decade, thousands of refugees and new immigrants have made the Salt Lake Valley home, and many are children who have seen violence, experienced hunger, and had little formal education after coming to the States. They face language and cultural barriers. They need help, and a new charter school is focusing on helping these kids advance and achieve. Joining me now to talk about the new Utah International School is Linda Barth. She is an instructional coach for Northwest Middle School in Salt Lake City School District. She also taught in New York City for a dozen years. She was in the Peace Corps, did a Fulbright in Mexico. She's now board chair of the new Utah International School, and she joins me in studio. Linda Barth, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Benjamin Horsley. He is spokesman for the Granite School District, which recently gave its nod of approval to the school. And Benjamin, thanks so much for your time today.
Glad to be here. Sorry my resume wasn't as long as Linda's.
I'll beef it up next time. If you've got questions or comments about the Utah International School model, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Linda, I want to start with you. Forming a charter school that supports this population of new immigrants and refugees, where did the idea come from?
After I moved here from New York City almost 2.5 years ago, I noticed a really big difference in the education that immigrants and refugees received here. And there were two big differences that made such an impact. And the first was that in New York City, students have a right to a free education until they're 21. And they also are placed in grade by the number of credits that they earn. Here in Utah, they have a free education until they're 18, and they're placed in grade by age. So a student who is 17 years old coming here for the, you know, from another country, not knowing a whole lot of English, has only just a few, it feels like minutes, to learn so much in so little time. So we did a ton of research to find out, you know, what keeps kids in school and what the educational on the brain research says about how they learn so that we can really optimize their learning. And what we found is that heterogeneous grouping, that means no tracking, really helps the achievement of all students. And an integrated project-based curriculum really helps students learn all the subjects faster and better and more in depth. And a small school, our school will only be about 500 students, and small schools help create just a better atmosphere and relationship with teachers, that students have with teachers, and that will help them stay in school.
Benjamin, the Granite School District Board recently had a lengthy discussion about this charter school application and recently approved it. What were some of the reasons why that you heard from board members?
Well, you know, the initial process was to have a study session and sit down with Linda and her folks and review the application and discuss the needs of our students. And we recognize that fully the breadth and offerings of our district is pretty extensive. However, there's some opportunities that we don't have to provide services to special students, and these at-risk students in particular, these refugee students, need some additional assistance and resources focused towards them. And that's unfortunately because certain civil rights legislation that we've programs we've attempted in the past have been kind of shot down, and so this is a great and unique opportunity to provide a resource to specific students, particularly these refugee students, that Granite really can't offer.
How many refugee students are in the Granite District right now?
We're serving a little over 700. I think it's about 760.
And how many languages are they? Are there native languages?
You know what? We have over 36 different languages spoken in a number of our schools. And so you can see that there's a great breadth of different diversity among the languages themselves. So it's a very difficult situation to bring all those communities and cultures together and try to bring them up to speed on an educational level, as Linda's mentioned, because the law requires us to place them by grade, by their age. That is a difficult situation we're placed in.
Hmm. We're speaking with Linda Barth. She's an instructional coach at Northwest Middle School, also the board chair of the new Utah International School, and also with us by phone, Benjamin Horsley, spokesman for Granite School District. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Linda, you are basing the new school on a model that is used in New York City. It's
yes.
A charter school there.
It's not a charter school.
It's not a charter
they're
school.
They're public schools. Yeah, there are
okay.
About 13 public schools in New York City.
I took a look online, a very unique circumstance. They had, I can't remember, it seemed like at least a dozen of their instructors were fluent in both English and another language, and sometimes languages that I've never even heard of. How is your approach going to be similar and maybe a little different from what you saw in New York City?
The organization of the school is going to be very similar. And what that organization is that students will study in cohorts of about 80 students. They'll have an instructional team of a science teacher, a math teacher, a language arts teacher, and a history teacher. And that instructional team will work on assessments and curriculum and all the planning and mentoring of those students for 2 years. So, you know, for 7th and 8th grade, they'll be with this instructional team, and then they'll move on to the 9th and 10th grade instructional team and so on. That model is going to be very similar. Our teachers probably won't speak a lot of languages, but you don't need to know another language to teach these students. I taught ESL to mostly Chinese students in New York, and I don't know any Chinese. What they need is just really what we call an EduSpeak scaffolded instruction. And what that means, or how that's different from traditional instruction, is that in a, you know, traditional high school classroom, a lot of teachers stand in front of the classroom and they talk to the students and the students take notes. But in our classroom, the teachers are going to have demonstrations, they're going to have pictures, they're going to have vocabulary development, they're going to have all kinds of ways to really enrich the instruction of these students so that they can be brought up to the level and to learn English as well.
And is that the goal and the mission? Is it to become fluent in English, or
Absolutely.
Is it to become a citizen, in a full-bodied citizen in
yeah.
every aspect? Is it about integrating into the culture, or is it about celebrating your native land? What are the mission statements for your school?
It's all of those things. I mean, to be a citizen, a contributing citizen, you need to learn how to speak English and write in English and go to college, be, you know, ready to take on a career or, you know, be in the workforce in the United States. But we also want to celebrate their cultures because they bring so much. And another part of aspect of our school is that we're really hoping to attract students who are interested in a school where an international perspective is taught and where they'll be able to go to school with kids from all over the world and have that type of experience. So we're really hoping that it's a cultural exchange and also a really high academically, an academic program with high standards for all of our students.
Benjamin Horsley, what kind of response have you been hearing from parents in the district of refugee kids or Granite School District board members toward this idea of creating a school dedicated to catering to the needs of international students?
We're very excited about the collaboration opportunity to work with some people, particularly Linda, some of these individuals who've done their research, have the expertise to be able to provide some of these resources to these students. Now, in the past, Granite has provided what we call the Newcomer Academy, and that's where the initial Office of Civil Rights Inquiry came from and why we suspended that program. But what it essentially did for our secondary students is place them one day, so they usually typically have an A or B day schedule, and so one of those days they would be at a specific location with some of these other refugee students where they'd be in their ESL, which is English as a Second Language class, and be provided some of those additional resources. But the OCR, or Office of Civil Rights Complaint, I don't want to call it complaint, initial inquiry, cited that this could potentially be segregation.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I mean, you can't help but think that, you know, you are separating a group of students. And is that really helpful?
Well, in the sense that it was providing them the resources they needed to enhance their language speaking abilities, enculturate them in everyday life here in the United States, yeah, it was very helpful. But at the same time, without providing them the opportunity to go and do some other things, if that's not what they were interested in, that's what why this charter school model and this opportunity is so intriguing to our board members, is that these students can choose to go and participate in that program, and that's not considered segregation.
Mm. Linda Barth, though, how do you answer that kind of initial reaction? You are separating a group of students who could use all the help that they can get from a mainstream school community. How do you reconcile those two?
Well, we actually, as a public charter school, we have to accept applications from everybody, not just refugees. So we really hope, and I want to reemphasize this, as I said before, we really hope to recruit a lot of native English-speaking students who are interested in going to school with people from all over the country and world. And we hope that we'll have maybe a 50-50 school population. So it's really not segregated, because we hope to recruit students who are interested in international perspectives and going to school with refugees and immigrants.
I understand this school will be based, at least initially, at Hartvigsen. The school will be vacant, or why Hartvigsen?
Hartvigsen's our special needs school. It serves children with special needs who are medically fragile, and it has some resources in that building. But the building in and of itself, as far as technology and things that we provide to that special population, is kind of outdated. And so while it's a great facility and a brick-and-mortar building, we did need to update some of those facilities, and we are actually reconstructing or rebuilding that school at another location in the district. And so that will open up this facility. Like I said, it's a great brick-and-mortar facility and will serve well as a classroom environment for this school. And so it just was a unique opportunity and situation where we could collaborate with these folks to provide these students this opportunity.
Benjamin Horsley, spokesman for Granite School District. Ben, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you. Have a great day.
And you too. And then Linda Barth is an instructional coach at Northwest Middle School, also board chair of the new Utah International School. And if people want more information about the school, where do they find it?
They can email me at saltlakeinternationalhs@gmail.com.
We'll
had
put a link.
Name change, yeah.
We'll put a link on the website. Linda Barth, thanks for your time
today.
Thank you. City Views is a production of KCPW News. Jesse Ellis, our technical director. Next time, solar energy in Utah and how you can harness the power of the sun. You can join us for that tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.